Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Economics Design Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by our guest, Alex Wetterman. Alex, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, you're the first member of a VC to join us on the podcast today. So I'm very excited to explore the topic of investing within the Web3 gaming space, as well as the metaverse. But before we jump into a conversation, do you want to give a quick intro about yourself?
Yeah, of course. First off, thanks again for having me. Super stoked to be here and definitely try to make an effort to do more of these. So again, appreciate you reaching out. A little bit about myself. Currently, I run the gaming group at Shima Capital. Shima Capital is kind of an early stage crypto fund focused on all segments within crypto. So even though I run the gaming practice, we've got guys that are experts in infra, DeFi, kind of the whole industry. And the gaming team, it's myself and then two other guys. One is Kevin, who was previously from Griffin Gaming Partners. And then the other is Jack, who was co-founder of Ray Player DAO and has done a lot of other cool things in the space in terms of kind of on-chain projects. But as far as myself, before I joined Shima about 6 months ago, I worked at a company called Alicorp. Alicorp is kind of like a venture fund, venture studio run by Kevin Ryan. Kevin Ryan used to be the CEO of DoubleClick. He's the founder of MongoDB, Business Insider, a couple other pretty prolific companies. And I helped kind of run some of the venture on the crypto side there, and then also on the venture studio side for crypto as well. For that, I worked at a company called CoinList, which is basically a blue chip token launch pad where I helped run token sales. So helped with stuff on the gaming side, like Guild of Guardians, helped with things on kind of the more consumer side, like Brain Trust, and then things on the infra side, like Agoric. But long story short, helped them not only on the token sales side, but also was one of the primary gaming guys internally and externally. So helped kind of vet some of the projects that we felt might or might not be a good fit for the platform. And then also helped kind of start thinking about what some of the initiatives might be in the gaming space in terms of building products internally. While I was working at CoinList, I honestly tried to do as much as I could in the space. So got connected with some funds and helped them diligence gaming deals, helped kind of start some DAOs in the space, one of which is called Chainforest, originally founded by Amit, a former NEA partner. And now Chainforest has kind of evolved into almost like an early stage pre-seed kind of venture DAO, where the community gets really deep on projects and then can kind of collectively take a look at deals that they want to invest in. And then also it kind of takes a venture studio model where Amit and the other members have leveraged their extensive network to bring in a lot of really sharp people in the Web3 space and kind of do that to, you know, build projects internally, bounce ideas off with each other, and then kind of take it from there.
Very cool. So let's jump into a conversation about Shima Capital and some of your role at the investment firm. I guess to start off, do you want to just share how much capital is being managed by Shima at the moment?
Yeah, so Shima raised just under 200 mil about a year and a half to 2 years ago. In terms of how much of that is allocated to gaming, I would say definitely a substantial portion of it. Not only is the gaming team, you know, as I mentioned, three of us, but I think I would say most people, or if not all of them, on the investment team have deep conviction in gaming. So Shima, again, not only invests in gaming, but I think everybody on the investment team has a deep appetite for getting more exposure and helping kind of build out the space.
Yeah, so that's cool. So let's walk through, you know, some of the processes on the VC side. So kind of provide a high level summary of what happens. So a project sends you a pitch deck or they reach out to you, then you have conversations. What does that whole entire process kind of look like?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of different ways in which deals will approach us. I think, you know, as you mentioned, one of the traditional forms is, hey, you know, deals may be shared. Founders may reach out. You take a look at the pitch deck. Maybe you set a call. And then it really kind of depends on the nature of the deal. So I think, you know, a common kind of process here is the gaming team as a whole kind of takes a look at the deck and decides whether it's something that is interesting to us or in a good fit for the fund as a whole. And we'll kind of hop on a call, just kind of learn a little bit about the founder, their vision, how the team came together. Then we will kind of decide whether the information collected on the call is enough or sufficient for us to kind of prep a little bit more thorough due diligence questions, or maybe there were certain things that weren't touched on the call that we saw in the deck or we've seen in the market, and maybe we'll set up a second call to kind of dig into some of those things. So after some of those introductory calls and sending over the due diligence questions, once the diligence responses come back from the founders, that usually enables us to dig a little bit deeper into some aspects of the deal that either we're particularly excited about or particularly concerned about in terms of potential risks and, you know, backing that company. So for us, I think after we kind of dig a little bit deeper and receiving due diligence responses, then kind of the determination becomes, okay, is this something that we want to bring to the team and to the investment committee? And then that's kind of where we'll discuss it as a group.
So I'm sure there's several factors to be considered when investing in a project. One of those, I'm sure, is receiving tokens versus equity within a game or within a project. Do you want to share Shima's perspective on this topic, what you're looking for, and how to maximize, I guess, the investment from the VC side?
Yeah, so I think that's a bit of a complicated answer. So I think today, you know, very interested in deals that are both equity and token, but I think the caveat there is, you know, it needs to make sense, right? I don't think it makes sense just to have equity and a token because that's kind of the type of deal profile that investors are looking for today. But rather, hey, what exactly is the business that you're building? And is this a business where a token provides value? And there's real utility to that token? And if so, then, you know, maybe the token makes sense. So for us, I think it's more about what exactly the business looks like and then making kind of an objective kind of determination on our end on what that deal structure ideally looks like. And at least in my experience, traditionally founders are usually extremely kind of amenable to work with us because we're not coming at this from like a financial perspective. We're coming at it from a, hey, what makes sense for the business you're trying to build perspective. And I would say, you know, another kind of important data point is oftentimes based on the current trends and the current state of the market, I think the deal structure may change. So for example, over the past year or two, maybe purely SAFT or token-only deals was more common, and I think we're starting to see the pendulum swing a little bit further on the other side of that spectrum.
Cool. And maybe we can walk through an example of a project to really talk about this point. But I mean, related to the tokens, as you mentioned, it's very specific to a project. How does that relate to whether a game has a single versus a dual token model? Is that something that's relevant to the decision?
Yeah, so again, I think this is the underlying like important point here is, okay, like why do you need a single token? Why do you need a dual token? And what really makes sense in the context of, if we're assuming we're talking about games or studios here, like the specific game or the ecosystem that you're trying to build. So for example, when I'm kind of taking a look at games, oftentimes one of the things that I take a look at are the progression systems within the games. Why is that? Well, I think progression systems lend themselves to tokenization in a lot of really cool ways. So in other words, if you play a hyper-casual game, it doesn't make a ton of sense because there's not a lot of progression baked into that game to have two or three or four different currencies within the game. You compare that with an MMORPG where maybe the skill tree is gated by a certain resource, maybe training is gated by another resource, maybe leveling up your character that enables kind of progression within the skill tree requires a different resource to be consumed. So I think the long story short is a lot of times we'll take a look at, in the context of games specifically, what those progression systems are, and then how you can kind of build tokens into those systems.
Interesting. So when it comes to investments, what round does Shima prefer to look for in fundraising?
Yeah, so she was an early stage fund. We prefer to kind of get in as early as possible and really roll up our sleeves and work with founders. So what does that mean? Generally pre-seed and seed stage deals. We'll do some select Series A, but I think generally that's a little bit more rare for us. And in terms of kind of doing deals on the pre-seed and seed stage side, you know, we're super excited to lead and co-lead deals. So again, yeah, we really like to work with founders and kind of leverage a lot of the cool tools that we have at Shima to help them grow and kind of pursue the vision that they have.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you could walk us through one or two of those tools or ways that you have helped founders in the past with their project.
Yeah, so, you know, as I was mentioning with the progression systems, we work a lot with our teams on token design, trying to figure out how do you build kind of a durable economy. So, for example, if you look at games that don't have kind of a crypto component, oftentimes these games have a kind of walled garden that prevents resources and resources within that economy from exiting the system or the ecosystem. With crypto, you have this kind of component where you can liquidate those resources. And you can pull resources out of the game. What does that do? Well, that creates a very different dynamic within the economy. So for us, we spend a lot of time talking with our porcos and working with them to identify with pretty extreme granularity what these players look like. For us, it's really important to understand the archetypes of players that exist in the ecosystem, and then to really drill down to which of those players you're going to target and why. So to give you an example, if you were building a game that doesn't leverage Web3 rails, traditionally you're trying to target maybe a casual audience, maybe a mid-core audience, maybe a hyper-competitive audience. But now, as you have these open economies, you now have to design games that also consider how speculators are going to interact with your economy, how investors are going to interact with it, how people that are maybe spectators but want some skin in the game want to participate. So for us, it's really important to understand, you know, who exactly you're building for, and then designing the game in parallel with the economy for those specific archetypes.
Interesting. And so one of the things you mentioned was that your investments can depend on the type of game genre, or the number of tokens and their use cases can relate to the game genre. Is there a preference for Shima's investments in games into a specific type of game genre?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a specific genre that we are more or less likely to invest in. I think it's more that there are certain economy designs that are well-suited for specific genres. And then once you take that approach, it's like, okay, well, do the other kind of aspects of the deal check out, right? In terms of, hey, is this something we're excited about? Do we get along with the founders, that sort of thing. So I think the short answer is that the genre is not necessarily a make or break sort of situation, but there are certain genres that, you know, we may be more excited about because of saturation in the market, right? So for example, if we see a bunch of shooters in the market, maybe that's a little bit oversaturated and we want to spend more time on a different segment that we think there's a bigger opportunity for. To kind of answer the question a little bit indirectly, rather than genre, one thing that we spend time looking at is the platform that's being built on, right? So not only do you want to consider what types of genres lend themselves with respect to maybe the progression systems, as the example that I alluded to earlier, to tokenization, but also what sort of mediums are a little bit more suited or well-suited for, again, Web3 Rails. And for us, we think it's a little bit more, we're spending a little bit more time as of late on maybe the mobile segment rather than, let's say, AAA games. And for, at least for me personally, I think a lot of that comes down to the profile of the founders building these and the experiences that come with those founders. So in other words, mobile developers are extremely seasoned in being data-driven in their decisions and shipping quickly and being extremely experimental. So in other words, they're very very familiar with A/B testing and really just going to the market and figuring out what the market wants. For us, given the tight alignment when you tokenize a game, create a really tight alignment between the builders and the founders and the developers and the end users or the consumers. So with this tight alignment, it becomes even more important to understand what your community wants and to build for that hyper-engaged audience. And for us, we felt like a lot of the mobile developers have shown a forte for some of these qualities. And I think that's another way to back into the types of genres or platforms that we're particularly excited about.
And I can imagine that also the amount of time, the number of years it takes to ship a really good quality game would have an impact in terms of, you know, Shima's strategy to invest in these projects. Do they invest in MMOs being developed, or is it primarily just these casual and web games?
So first off, I think that's a great point. You kind of hit the nail on the head. One of the concerns with AAA is that it takes a lot of time to actually get that game launched, right? And not even launch, just pre-launch, get a beta, get an alpha, get something in people's hands. And kind of in the current market landscape, it's become increasingly difficult, at least in comparison to the past 2 years, to raise capital in this environment. So If you assume that's more difficult to raise capital, then you have to be extremely intentional about kind of managing runway and figuring out how you can find, like using creative ways, how you can find traction within the market. This is something that I've been chatting with a lot of friends about recently. You know, you don't have to ship a game to figure out whether you have market validation for the product you're trying to build. At the end of the day, games are consumer products. You can go and kind of gauge the consumer appetite for what you're building just by going out and saying, hey, you know, here's kind of our idea, here's our vision, here's some art, whatever, here's what we're trying to build, like sign up on this whitelist and we'll keep you guys posted, right? So it can be a Substack, it can be a Google Play pre-registration, it can be a Steam wish list. And these are all metrics that investors are tracking. These are things that I take a look at daily. They're freely accessible. You can take a look at them on the web, but just great ways to gauge market sentiment. A lot of cool ways to drive important information from those wish lists, from those pre-registrations, et cetera. So kind of backing into your earlier question about genres, you can take a look at what games have the highest registrations on wish lists to determine which genre is the current market has the most appetite for it.
So on the topic of looking into some of these resources, what other resources are you and the team and potentially other VCs using to really drive their decisions that would be accessible to people just interested in learning about these projects?
Yeah, so, myself and the team have spent a lot of time on some of these like mobile data sites, such as like data.ai, atmagic.rocks, Sensor Tower, etc. We think even though you're not providing a ton of information on the Web3 side, you can still get some pretty granular insights with respect to how certain mobile segments are performing, what sort of genres are, getting the highest downloads, taking a look at what the ARPUs look like for different types of segments across different types of markets. So for us, especially on the mobile side, really drilling into what kind of the market looks like, not just in the US, but abroad, in APAC, et cetera, to figure out, okay, how is a potential studio or a potential investment really going to go out and attack the market? Because if you think about how people spend time online and how they play games, oftentimes, these people are not staring at a blank screen. They're not staring at like a Google Chrome browser that they haven't really performed a search for. These people are already browsing the web. They're already playing games. So the question then becomes, how do you convert these users? And backing into kind of the mobile comment earlier, mobile gamers are much more likely to download a variety of different games. In contrast, hyper-competitive gamers are much more likely to stick to their forever games. They're much less willing to try out new types of games. I think there's a caveat there for if the new game is something that might be a mod of the forever game that they're already playing. This is something that I've written about a little bit in the past, but if you kind of track the history of the most popular competitive esports games, they all come from mods. So RTS to MOBA, you've got kind of simulation games to BRs, et cetera, et cetera.
That's cool. I'm wondering what role psychology, player psychology, or just human psychology is implemented within the research or when it's in used as a basis of information for some of the investments. What role does that play? Or is it not really at play in more finance and typical econ, processes are taking place there?
Could you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by kind of psychology here?
Yeah, sure. So my question is based on our understanding of player psychology. So for example, when someone's most likely to spend something, how do you encourage someone to go from a Web 2 game to a Web 3 game? How do we, debunk some of these false claims around Web3 games based on what they were a couple of years ago? How does that play a role in some of the thought process that Shima has?
I think it's extremely important, right? Like the kind of baseline question of how are you going to convert users? How are you going to get people to download your game, play your game, give feedback, etc.? It's all driven by gamer psychology, right? As I was just kind of describing about the mentality of different types of gamers, these are things that you should lean into. And another thing that I think, at least for games in kind of the Web3 space, don't need to be reinvented, right? We're not kind of creating this new type of gamer. Obviously, there's new types of games that are much more focused on kind of engaging with the crypto native audience. But the majority of players are not that audience. And the majority of players are well-researched and well-understood. And I think there's a lot of data points that you can take a look at to drive decisions in the investment process that can kind of help.
So when a game approaches you, and let's say they might have NFTs or they might not have NFTs, or there might be some games or some parts of the game that are on-chain and other parts off-chain, that variable, you know, on versus off-chain, how does that influence you and your team's decision to invest in a project?
I think the most important question is why. So, you know, why are certain aspects of your game on-chain? Just because you can put it on-chain doesn't mean it needs to be there. There's a lot of negatives to putting certain aspects on-chain. There's a lot of pros to just keeping those assets in a centralized database. So if you're trying to craft, you know, maybe a new experience that leverages the openness and the permissionless nature of a blockchain, then, you know, that might be a good answer. In terms of, okay, are you going to have a token? Are you going to have NFTs? What does that look like? Does value accrue to the token? Is it more just a medium of exchange token? Does value actually accrue to the NFT? These are all considerations that we're thinking deeply about. And for us, I don't think there's necessarily a correct answer, but there is, a vision or a why that we're really looking for founders to have a pretty thorough understanding of. For us, this usually comes in the form of having done pretty deep research into kind of the different market categories and market segments, and then articulating, hey, you know, not only do I plan to, in one example, have value accrue to the NFTs, but here's why, and here's some of the potential risks in this model, and here's how we plan to mitigate those risks. So I think that the best answers that I've heard and that I think the rest of the team has heard often comes down to this holistic analysis of, hey, why exactly are you doing this? And if you can answer that question in a thorough way, you know, hats off to you.
So I guess maybe to just follow up on that question, would you be able to speak to then any trends that exist within the space that have to do with certain assets being on versus off chain?
Yeah, I think it, you know, you can look at the different genres and platforms of games. So for example, right, if you think about like traditional arena shooters, there's very little progression in arena shooters. So I'm talking about the Overwatch, the Call of Duty, et cetera. So what does progression look like in those games? It might look like unlocking characters in Overwatch. With Overwatch 2, I guess you get all the characters. You can kind of earn them, I guess, through playtime, but that's kind of beyond the point. But I think the moral of the story is that if you look at arena shooters, the progression is usually confined to battle passes within the games. So if the progression is confined to the kind of the battle pass itself, then I think that kind of limits the opportunity to tokenize the game itself. Now, you can include a fungible token, but let's take a step back and try to look at this through the lens of gamers today, right? Do gamers really care about how many Call of Duty points they have? Do they care how many Riot points they have or how many Robux they have? I would argue they don't really care at all. They care about the skins that they have. They care about maybe the clout that they have in the game. They care about kind of flexing within the game. They care about other kind of, you know, other avenues of where tokenization can exist within that game. Then you compare that with a MMORPG, right? Let's look at World of Warcraft. Very different analysis, very different. Not only do you have the cosmetics, but you also have these raw materials, right? And I think, you know, long-term, MMOs are much more well-suited to having more assets on-chain because there's a reason to have them on-chain because there's like a marketplace that's already baked into kind of the core game loop. And now you add this Web3 component that enables that marketplace to have deeper liquidity because it's connected across the entire kind of Web3 gaming ecosystem. So in other words, rather than just trading within World of Warcraft, you might be trading assets between World of Warcraft on a third-party marketplace with somebody who's playing another MMORPG, right? Final Fantasy 14, et cetera, something else. So for us, I don't think it all comes down to genre, but I think genre is a really great way to understand not only game design, but how games are monetized. And I think it's pretty illuminating in terms of how you can kind of add certain Web3 features to those existing games, where design games are all the Web3 features in and of itself.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analysis. I want to go back to something we were mentioning a little bit earlier, which is some of the mindset for people who are looking to invest in projects, you and your team. My understanding is it's pretty much a needle in a haystack, where you go through hundreds upon thousands of pitch decks and speak to hundreds of founders, and you choose one or two. So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more about that mindset If you could allow our listeners to put themselves in the shoes of a VC and really understand what they're looking for, why they're looking for it, like what are those intuitive parts that might not be something on paper that you look for?
Yeah, so I think if I'm stepping back or I'm stepping into kind of the founder position, I think one thing that oftentimes gets a little overlooked is founders doing research on the funds themselves and really thoroughly understanding the theses of the fund. So in other words, if I'm pitching fund A, I want to know exactly what fund A thinks about the market that I'm trying to operate in. And if I can really understand how they think about the market, then I can curate my pitch and my business to the thesis that those guys are looking to invest in. In other words, you can also look at their portfolio companies to understand strategic synergies between maybe the company that you want to build today and how your company can provide value, not just to the fund, but to all the portfolio companies in a way that is much more strategic than maybe a one-off investment that sits outside the rest of the portfolio. To your comment in, hey, you know, VCs are looking at a bunch of deals, how do you become that kind of diamond in the rough? I don't know if there's a straight answer. I think the best way is to try to form relationships with VCs to understand how they're thinking about the market. So that way, when it's time for you to go out and raise a round, you know who you should be chatting with because you're already connected with the guys that are working in the industry and you know, hey, I'm going to go approach this or that VC for this or that purpose. And in doing so, you become much more intentional with your approach and your pitch becomes much more refined. So it's a tough question to answer. I'm sure everybody you ask will have a different answer. But for me, a lot of it is, hey, step in the shoes of the investor, right? The investor spends all day, every day looking at the market. So you probably don't want to spend 75% of your slide deck or your pitch deck talking about the market that they're intimately familiar with. I was just chatting with somebody about this the other day. Honestly, sometimes you set yourself up for failure in doing that. So to give you a concrete example, if I'm looking at the market landscape for the game that you're trying to build or the market you're trying to penetrate, there's two easy ways you can set yourself up for failure. One is you don't include certain companies operating in that market, which means you just haven't done enough research, which isn't that great of a look. And two, maybe you intentionally remove some of those participants in the market. So that way you can kind of play up the good facts in the deck, which again is a red flag because it means you're not being completely, you're not giving complete disclosure, especially in a market where, again, we're spending all day, every day thinking about it. So this isn't the time to be testing or informing us about the market because we're not thinking about it. And if you're chatting with a VC who isn't thinking about that market, this goes back to my earlier point about being intentional about who you speak with, probably not the right investor to be chatting with. And you could probably be spending your time, or that time could probably be better spent elsewhere. So just how I'm thinking about it.
So, you know, a key point you made there is, okay, put yourself in the shoes of the VC, understand what they're thinking about the market. So my question for you is, how are you thinking about the market?
Big question. So for us, we're extremely, extremely interested in deploying right now, still extremely active, right? As you mentioned, we see a lot of deals. I think the deal cadence was slowing down a little bit towards the end of last year, but at least over the past 3 to 4 weeks, the pace has definitely picked back up and hit a right kind of back where we were. So, you know, what are some things that we're trying to spend time on? Honestly, trying to kind of build out my Twitter presence to make this as transparent and blunt as possible. So a couple of things that we're looking at right now, as I mentioned, mobile, maybe more specifically about mobile, I'm looking at games that have kind of genre merging. So in other words, if you track kind of the performance of games over the past 2 years, rather than looking at maybe the match 3 genre or the 4X genre or the shooter genre, some of these games that previously did not have an existing brand or existing IP that can help kind of propel them into the limelight come from this unique kind of approach of combining those other kind of well-known genres that exist in the gaming space. So in other words, if you combine a tower defense game with RPG, that's something that provides a fresh experience to gamers that they may not have seen yet, but it also keeps switching costs relatively low because you're coming at it from the angle of, hey, what are two types of games that mobile gamers are intimately familiar with and have been playing for the past decade? Okay, well, how do we kind of one up that experience and craft something that's fresh for them and then leverage that to build a fresh IP or a fresh brand? Another example is, as I mentioned, I used to be an IP attorney, so I can understand how valuable IP is, and I can understand how IP enables you to build a variety of different business lines that will all compound. And maybe that IP is originated from a video game, or maybe it's being leveraged in a video game to then become one of the core pillars of the different business lines that they're going to kind of build out underneath that IP umbrella. So what am I looking for here? IP or brands that can kind of help bridge the gap between Web 2 and Web 3, or whatever you want to call it. Spending a lot of time looking at on-chain games. I think this is a little bit more of an experimental category, but generally I think the idea is you can't really put a lot of game logic on-chain today. But what can you put on-chain? You can put certain types of economies on-chain. And what can you do with that? Well, you can create assets that then are designed to be modded and forked. So that way you layer on top a variety of maybe UGC or games built by the community that are games that the community itself wants to play. And then you have value still accrue back down to that underlying economy, which is something that's relatively investable from my perspective. So looking at on-chain games that are kind of designed from the ground up for an existing community that also has an appetite to kind of build on top of the foundation that this core devs are going to provide.
Cool. So we fleshed out gaming investments quite a bit from the first half of the conversation. I'd like to ask about some of the metaverse investments that Shima has made. So my understanding, the metaverse, as described in across social media, is, you know, let's say, not growing in popularity at this point. It's a trend that seems to be dying out slightly, and whether or not that's something that continues forward is something to be seen. So I'm wondering, are these metaverse investments something that are still of interest to be continued doing from Shima's perspective, or is this something that's kind of a fad in the past?
Yeah, good question. We're still definitely open and interested in metaverse plays. I think metaverse is a tricky term. I think the metaverse, as it's kind of been, like what the narrative has been over the past year or two, something that's a little convoluted. So in other words, I think a lot of times, how do people define the metaverse? I think one of the first terms that comes to mind is interoperability. And for me, interoperability is something that's become a little jaded over the past year or two. So just to kind of contextualize, right? A lot of people think about, okay, in Web3, you can buy one asset, take that asset into Call of Duty, and maybe take it into Fortnite, and then maybe take it into Warcraft. I just don't think we're really there yet. As an avid gamer, I play Call of Duty Warzone all the time. And even Warzone has issues kind of creating a skin from a previous iteration of Call of Duty multiplayer and then transposing that into kind of the current iteration of Warzone. So what's kind of the important takeaway from that? Well, AAA studios are still trying to figure out how to do interoperability within single title games. So when you try to extrapolate that to, hey, how do you bring a skin from Call of Duty into Overwatch or something else? I think it's just going to take some time. So one of the things that I'm looking at in kind of the metaverse space is, okay, what do NFT metadata standards look like, right? How do you build the rails that enable this interoperability that people are envisioning are going to happen? I think on the flip side, another thing to consider is, you know, what exactly does interoperability look like? I don't think it's going to look so different from how it looks in games today. So I think in games today, the best way to look at it is you look at different publishers and how exactly they do cross-game, activations. How do they do kind of cross IP events? And then to kind of promote brand awareness across each of those games and each of those segments without necessarily selling an asset that then will be utilized in a variety of different types. So for me, I think what does interoperability look like short to medium term? I think it looks more like, hey, you have an asset in Call of Duty, and that asset in Call of Duty gives you some right or gives you the ability to redeem something in another game. And then over time, when you have NFT metadata standards that become a little bit more commonplace, you can start to basically build marketplaces for these cross-promotional events where, hey, I have kind of this IP that connotes, a significant brand awareness within the eyes of the consumer. Okay, well, somebody's going to probably bid up the price of trying to pull that IP into maybe the mobile title that they've been developing that doesn't have kind of the same brand recognition that the former does.
Yeah, that's interesting. And one of the things that came to mind about this interoperability, although not typically related to the metaverse, or arguably is virtual LAN. So I spoke with Lars Doucet on the podcast recently, who was a writer at Novik and studied virtual LAN in a bunch of these metaverse and Web3 games. And one of the issues with virtual LAN, opposed to it already being a trend that's kind of slowing down at this point, is the fact that it acts as a mechanism to prevent people from entering the ecosystem. So if you need to participate, you need to buy land. And then all of a sudden, you no longer have as many people engaging in your ecosystem. And there's also just issues that surround economic policies that are being changed over time, such as the use of a land, piece of land in Axie Infinity, prior to some changes, was more useful than it is today. So on the topic of virtual land, is that something that's in interest or not really an interest from Shima's perspective?
Yeah, I don't think I have a strong opinion on, hey, should you kind of incorporate virtual land, or if the game includes virtual land, is that a red flag? I don't think so. I think the issue surrounding virtual land comes into how do you use that virtual land to kind of acquire users? So in other words, are you doing a land sale before the game is even live? That's something that I'm not as interested in, right? As a gamer, I just want to see the game, right? I want to see what you're building. I want to be involved in kind of core gameplay loops and kind of defining what the experience will look like. If land is a core component to that, then, there may be a strong argument to, hey, okay, a land sale does make sense. But in my opinion, I think for the vast majority of games that are building in this space, I think they're kind of looking at these land sales as a way to kind of raise capital through the community. But then that if you don't have a launch, or you don't have some way in which people can kind of utilize or use that land, I think they're going to very quickly become soured with respect to the sentiment of the game as a whole. So for me, it really comes down to, okay, what do gamers want? What do they look for? Like, they're not looking to just pre-order a game that they don't even know what the game looks like. I don't think that meta is going to exist for very long. But, I think there are certain games that are well-suited for land. So I don't think land sales should be written off as a whole. I just think they need to be carefully considered.
Interesting. And one thing, or I guess two more topics to cover today on the podcast. I want to talk about negotiating vesting schedules. So, I've read a bunch of white papers and I've read a bunch of different token economic designs. I've read a bunch of different vesting schedules. Could you share a little bit more about how that works from the side of the VC? Obviously, from the side of the VC, you want to have as much value that you can, return on your investment through these games or through these tokens. What's the most ideal vesting schedule? What information do you rely on to decide a vesting schedule and tokenomic model for that matter?
Yeah, really good question. I'm going to give you the lawyer answer. The lawyer answer is it depends. For example, it kind of depends on, what exactly does the fungible token look like? So to give you kind of two contextual examples, you can have example A, where there's a fungible token that's used in a single title. And then two, you may have an ecosystem token, right? Where it's like maybe a publisher has a token and that token will be leveraged across a wide array of different titles. Well, in the former example, one thing that might be kind of instructive is taking a look at the numbers in terms of, what type of genre is this game? And what's a typical shelf life for this type of game, right? If you're looking at the mobile segment, it's, there are forever games, but the majority of games are not forever games. So if it's not a forever game, then, not looking at the best case scenario, what's the range of performance here? And in looking at that range, you can try to figure out, if the traditional shelf life of the game is 4 or 5 years, well, you might want to design a vesting schedule that is suited for the shelf life of the game itself. In contrast, if you're doing an ecosystem token, then that may look a little bit different because the token is utilized in a different way throughout those different titles. So for us, just spending a lot of time with the teams themselves, with other kind of experts in space to figure out what makes the most sense for the particular deal.
So are you able to walk us through any examples of a vesting schedule that might be better than another vesting schedule, depending on a game genre, a little bit more detail on that point?
Yeah, I think it's tough to give some like pretty concrete details just because I think we're like very much in the early stages here. So people are still trying to figure out what vesting schedules make a ton of sense. Now I think, there's pros and cons to making, having a higher float to those tokens. And a lot of times that kind of comes down to the utility of the token, right? If it's purely kind of a governance token, well, you know, what does kind of that activated audience look like who will actually be actively engaged in the governance? In contrast, if it's something that's more of a medium of exchange, then I think it depends a little bit less. And it's more about, okay, ensuring that you have the right syncs and faucets implemented within the game to kind of manage that kind of supply and demand within the game, which, you know, it bounces up and down depending on kind of the slow drip of content, the live ops, right? The seasonality of content as it's kind of brought into the game, those types of things. So the short answer is I don't have a great example for you because I think we're kind of seeing this playing out in real time. I think, as I mentioned, I think what's instructive is being intentional with this. This isn't something where you kind of, you know, just pull a number out of a hat. I think there's certain data that can be leveraged by teams and by investors and by others to find kind of fastest schedules that make sense, but there will also be some trial and error that we see kind of play out over the next year or two.
Okay. And last question for you, Alex. So you're a lawyer, you've been part of venture capital teams, you've been part of different startups. So you've been around the block. Do you have any recommendations for younger people who are interested in the Web3 space? Maybe they're interested in venture capital, maybe they're interested in finance or gaming or anything related to what you're working on or have worked on in the past?
Yeah, I think there's probably two recommendations I would have. The first one is to take a step back and understand how nascent this industry is, and then to realize that even though there are people that have, you know, maybe a laundry list of credentials who have been working in a variety of different spaces, they can only have been working in crypto for so long. So in terms of the arbitrage those people have from a relatively new industry that hasn't been around for that long, I think it's relatively low. So for me, a lot of it is just pushing yourself to follow kind of your genuine curiosity. For me, you know, as somebody who spent time as an attorney and realized it wasn't really for me, just diehard gamer who was also deeply interested in cryptography, and these worlds kind of collided. So for me, I would really push people to not only follow their curiosity, but also try to build out that network and connect with people that share kind of the similar insights or share kind of the similar views that you may have. And I would say you kind of approach the people that have similar views to initially build out your network. And I think you can leverage platforms like Twitter to do that. I think Twitter is a phenomenal platform. But then after you kind of build out that network, then you should look outside kind of that echo chamber to find people who may be sparring partners or really just kind of push you to kind of play devil's advocate, right? And to kind of, just understand what kind of the strongest positions are on the other side of the table from whatever you think about kind of the future of the industry.
Cool. Alex, it was great to have you and speak to a VC on the podcast today. Thanks so much for spending the time talking to me today.
Yeah, man, really appreciate it. And love what you've been doing with the pod and excited to stay tuned. So thanks again for the invite. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Okay, thanks everyone.